walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Elias Weiss Friedman, a photographer specializing in dogs known as the Doggist. Chiefly shooting dogs, he meets on the street in and around New York City. Friedman has created an enormously popular body of work. The Doggist has 1.7 million followers on Instagram. More recently, he published a book, also called The Doggist, which presents photographs of more than 1,000 dogs, representing a sweeping array of breeds. Tied to his work, Friedman has also created the Give a Dog a Bone program to tell the story of shelter dogs, get them adopted, and raise awareness as well of the plight of pit bulls. We'll explore various aspects of the world of the Doggist and get to that conversation with Elias Weiss Friedman in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also, later in the program, I'll speak briefly with Loretta Williams, event coordinator for St. Francis Society Animal Rescue, about its Hambingo on Domingo fundraising event happening this Sunday at Hamburger Mary's. Lastly, it's incumbent on me to mention that WNS Winter Fund Drive starts next week. Yikes! I'm typically assigned a fundraising goal of $3,000, which is pretty over the top considering that the Fund Drive edition of Talking Animals is less than an hour long. 55 minutes, in fact. Yikes again! So the only hope I have of making that $3,000 goal is to receive pledges and donations before that Fund Drive show. How about right now? As usual, we have exclusive Talking Animals thank you gifts for donations at various levels, including fantastic tickets to see Willie Nelson March 4th at Ruth Eckert Hall, a show all but sold out, a special deal on a week-long stay at a condo on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, and copies of the latest books by Dr. Carl Savina and Tracy Stewart, yes, wife of John Stewart, signed in both cases by the authors, and many more thank you gifts that you can only receive by donating in support of Talking Animals. Please head to talkinganimals.net for all the details and fast, easy ways you can pledge early. We have early bird specials. We can cut you deals on some of these things if you pledge now. So before we speak, though, with Elias Weiss Friedman, I thought we'd hear an animal song that I think fits perfectly with our discussion with the Doggist. We played this a couple of months ago. It's the Bottle Rockets with Dog on Talking Animals.
I love my dog. He's my dog. If you don't love my dog, that's okay. I don't want you to. He's my dog. I love my dog. He's my dog. If my dog don't love you, that's okay. I don't want him to. He's my dog. Sometimes it's just this simple. Sometimes life is just this simple. Sometimes life is really just this simple. I love my dog. I love my dog. He's my dog. If my dog don't love you, that's okay. I don't want him to. He's my dog. I love my dog, he's my dog. If you don't love my dog, that's okay. I don't want you to, he's my dog. Sometimes it's just this simple. Sometimes life is just this simple. Sometimes life is really just this simple. I love my dog. This isn't about you, it's about my dog.
my dog, that's okay. I don't want you to, he's my dog.
That's new music from the Bottle Rockets with perhaps the perfect song for this moment. It's simply entitled Dog. Right now, let's move into our conversation with Elias, the doggist, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Elias Weiss-Friedman to Talk Animals. Good morning, Elias.
How's it going?
Good. Thanks for joining us this morning on Talking Animals.
Glad to be here.
Just before I came on the air, I checked, and depending on what the morning was like for you, maybe you might have already posted a photo or two, but at least right before last time I checked, I didn't see any, but I'm sure there will be some shortly, correct?
Shortly, yes. You know, it's funny, this time of year, there are fewer dogs that are out because the walks are shorter as well.
You got to aim for sort of prime time, I guess, in these days, yeah. Of course, we'll circle back to photos and dogs and walking and the Instagram account, the book, and more, but first, I have to believe a guy whose work reflects such a passion for dogs and truly an understanding of them was a total dog guy from the get-go. You obviously grew up with dogs, it seems. Maybe even you were raised by them. I'm not sure.
Yes. There were always sort of like a collection of five dogs amongst our family. So, yes, I'm part dog. I've always had a connection with them. And, I grew up with labs and poodles, and we had a pug once. And yeah, my aunt's a vet, and we actually had our labs had two litters. So I sort of have always been around dogs, and it's kind of strange. I actually don't have my own dog right now, but I think that's because I miss them, and that's why I do my project.
Yeah, it might blunt your work ethic in some way. If you had your own dog just sitting there in the apartment with you, it'd be like, well,
exactly.
Why am I going out in search of a dog? I got one right here. So
it's a catch-22, yeah.
That's it. So you say there were always kind of five dogs. Was that just sort of by circumstance, or did your family feel like, hey, we don't want any less than five at any given time if we can help it?
Well, my immediate family had two dogs, Ruby and Matilda, and then we would always spend our summers together with my first cousins. So they had Snowy and Teapaws and Rigby and Bialy, and my grandmother had Maggie and Oreo, and I'm
wow.
missing a few. But so that, it was sort of like you can picture a house filled with 10 people and five dogs. That's kind of a painted picture.
For sure. And consistent with what we now find in the doggist world, it seems like any and all breeds were welcome and loved and supported.
That's right. And, I was always photographing our own dog. I was always a photographer as a hobbyist, but I didn't see the idea of sort of chasing other people's dogs as a viable profession.
I want to jump into that in a sec, but looking back to those years where you had at least the two in your own immediate family and then met up with the other sort of extended family for the extended dog family. Looking back, what did dogs really mean to you back then? I mean, do you recall feeling a special bond or connection with these dogs as some kids do? Other kids sometimes feel like, hey, they're fine with dogs around, but they sort of take them for granted. They don't really feel like that plugged into them.
Yeah. Well, they're your friend. I was always kind of a shy kid growing up, and I just sort of, having a dog was a special relationship for me. I always thought they were really funny, too. Like, I would entertain my siblings by doing dog ventriloquism, where I'd speak on our dog's behalf.
I see. Was he making his demands known, or what sort of things were you presenting in his case?
You know, like, Henry, you never scratch my belly, or when am I going to get my treats? Henry.
Okay.
You know, just sort of
basic dog needs. Yeah.
Yeah. And, creating, images, and we'd actually do some videos of them and like play the music from Cops, like bad boy, and it was just kind of like a silly thing, but it was always sort of like what I laughed at the most and had the most fun doing.
Right. So really, there was an early connection, and also early on too, you kind of made a reference to it already, but you grew up in a house where photography was important, kind of a serious pursuit. I think maybe you could talk a little bit about your dad's interest in photography and what impact that had on you.
Yeah, so he would always photograph us every year, each of the kids, in sort of a formal portrait with a medium format camera, and develop them. We had a darkroom in the house, and Pritham himself. And so you'd see on each of the staircases in our summer house would be our sort of going through adolescence, our, you know, from age, 10 upward or even earlier, you'd see an evolution of us. But so that's sort of how I developed my portrait aesthetic, I guess you could say, like a sort of simple, straightforward square. I always loved like cameras and adventuring with them and being the person to sort of take the photo of at parties, and it gave me a sense of purpose.
And this was, at least as far as your dad goes, and therefore maybe others, including yourself, this was, again, a serious pursuit. I mean, he had a dark room, right, if I'm not mistaken?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had his own dark room, and I used it too. Both my parents are physicians, so it wasn't, I like the idea of photography, but I didn't want to sort of pursue it directly because I didn't want to become an event photographer. You know, I wanted to be an artist, if anything.
Yeah, it's interesting because something like having photography in and around the house and even a dark room, those things can sort of cut either direction when you're a kid. Like, you become really interested in something precisely because it is a passion of your dad's, or it's the last activity you want to pursue,
right,
precisely because it's what your dad does. So sounds like you definitely are in the first camp and really got sort of taken with it early on.
Yeah, well, you know, they never really pressured me either way. You know, one thought was to follow my parents' sort of conventional become a doctor. I'm the oldest son, but that sort of never really stuck with me because, you know, I didn't really love school. I didn't want to spend my 20s in school. And I just, the rest of the story is maybe we'll get to in a minute. But I've always had a thing for photography, and that it was, I wasn't very good at drawing, but I loved gadgets and I loved interacting with people and portraying them in my own way. And, sharing that.
Yeah. Well, let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Elias Weiss Friedman, the canine photographer known as the Doggist. He has a book out featuring photos of some 1,000 dogs or more, also called the Doggist. If you'd like to ask Elias a question about taking pictures of your dog or offer a comment about one thing or another, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So you grow up that way, then you kind of move past your formative years, you're growing up and heading off to college. At that stage, do dogs continue to be part of your life, or are those sort of dogless years?
Those are the dogless years.
Yeah.
Ruby, my dog growing up, she passed away, I guess, right before college.
Mm.
And then, you know, I went to college. I was in Boston, and I was making new friends, and I still love dogs, but I think I repressed it a bit then.
Yeah. Those are tricky years sometimes, depending on where you are, where you're living, what the circumstances are to really look after a dog properly. Yeah.
Of course.
So you're in the college years. Those are largely dogless years, but you've grown up with dogs. You've grown up with photography. If you don't sort of mind recounting this for, I'm sure, the umpteenth time, walk me through how those things merged post-college, or some years post-college, and photographing dogs began in earnest, really kind of the beginning days of the Doggist, I guess, as it were.
Sure, sure. So in school, I majored in psychology and business, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with that. I graduated and I moved to New York and I started an internship at a brand strategy agency. And then I got a job there. So while I was there, I was learning about how to tell stories, you know, how to tell brand stories, and learning the importance of simplicity in everything you do. So I was there for 2 years, and then the best thing happened. I got fired.
Okay.
I was part of like a layoff of 40 people, and it was a little bit scary, but I think that was sort of the moment that I was waiting for.
Without realizing it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, it's like you go to elementary school, you go to middle school, you go to high school, you go to college, and then you get your first job. Those are all sort of like the prescribed thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally I was 25 and I could do anything I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, like I had a fresh notebook to figure out what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so I started, instead of going back to the job circus immediately in New York, which would have been just as easy, I got involved with my buddies in the startup world and relaunched a company called WeFollow, which is a Twitter directory, and then we sold it within 7 months.
Wow.
So that was a successful thing. but I sort of got bit by the bug of being autonomous and working in a creative space and being my own boss, essentially, and making my own time. So after that, I still didn't want to get a real job, so I started a show, and here's where the dogs come in.
Okay.
I started a show called Barking at Dog, where we would, I went around with my buddy, and we'd interview people's dogs on world news and topical issues, and subtitle in their, my interpretation of their response.
Well, I have to say a couple things here, Elias. First of all, as a guy who hosts a show called Talking Animals, I totally applaud the concept. And also, it seems like it, in some ways it harks back to the dog ventriloquism when you were a kid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So, I was like you're saying, I sort of was bringing out this latent thing from my childhood. That felt really, like, fun. And, like, you know, I had been doing the agency job where I was wearing, nice shirts and stupid pants and stupid shoes. and now I was, like, finally, like, letting loose again, shaking it off and having fun.
Yeah.
And realizing, like, I love dogs. And they, I think at that time I was a little bit sort of jaded about people and, corporate ladders and the whole, the New York rat race, essentially.
Yeah.
So dogs aren't, caught up in that. And they don't say, if I want to interact with them, they don't say no.
Right.
So that was sort of the first step where, and it's actually still up there, barkingatdog.com. It's one of the funniest things, I think. But it was sort of, it was difficult to get a lot of momentum with a project like that I'm producing myself, where you're only sort of accosting people on the street and, like, getting their dogs all riled up. But then producing it, putting it all together and trying to do that, like, every couple weeks, it was just sort of, I was barking up the wrong tree a little bit.
Yeah, Yeah, wordplay accepted, but it also sounds very kind of labor intensive for something that to me sounds cool and entertaining, but was probably pretty much a little bit on the niche side as far as the appeal. Yeah,
that's right. But in promoting that, I was starting to take portraits, pictures of dogs. I just started snapping and instead of videotaping, and that was sort of the next epiphany. Was like, I can take photos of dogs, and I posted one of them to my own Instagram and got much more engagement than anything else I was posting. So I was like, well, I can just create a separate account here and just post dog pictures.
Yeah.
And so then another week goes by, and I'm like, well, no one's done the Sartorialist for dogs. And the Sartorialist is run by Scott Schumann, who takes portraits of sort of people wearing fashion, with fashion, in New York and abroad, and there's sort of his own sort of aesthetic to that. And I said, what if someone could do that for dogs? So hence the dogist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after how many times, shooting and posting, did it go in your mind from, hey, this is kind of fun, taking pictures of dogs and posting them, people seem to like it, to, hey, I'm really onto something here, and I'm gonna kind of keep going and see how far this thing can go.
Yeah, I kind of knew very early on. I remember I was photographing a Frenchie in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, and he said, "What's this for?" And I said, "The doggist." It wasn't something I'd said before, and he's like, "Oh." And then my friends looked at me and they're like, "That worked." So then the next day I was the first post to the account, and I sort of, like, I could taste what the future would bring at that point. Like, I knew that if I was consistent and stuck to it and did it every single day, that there's no way people wouldn't love it. And that became the case very quickly. For the first 10,000 followers, I was cruising hashtag dog and liking people's pictures, sort of just to get my name out there.
Yeah.
But if you're photographing people's dogs in New York, there are lots of influential owners out there, and I was making their dog famous, so, and taking a great portrait of them. So it sort of quickly, next thing you know, I photographed someone's dog to do something that someone at Huffington Post. So the Huffington Post picked me up, and then I did some TV after that, and then the next thing you know, it was 50,000 followers. And then BuzzFeed turned it into another 15,000 followers. And so then it started to, it was a thing. It became sort of the ball's rolling at that point.
And it sounds like in some ways, while you had gotten off the prescribed path and gotten, you know, didn't have to put on your dress shirt and tie and goofy pants and shoes, whatever,
right,
that in some ways you were, you know, putting into practice some of the stuff that you'd learned in those years at the brand strategy firm.
That's right.
Because it sounds like you are quickly sort of determined that if you just went up to somebody and said, hey, I'm Elias Weiss Friedman, I'd like to take your picture, I have a website, whatever, be like, you know, maybe. But you said, hey, this is for the doggist. It just seems like that difference alone maybe made the encounter different.
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, I learned so much during my time working at an agency. I think I learned much more than I did in college. But just, yeah, like a name is important. Right.
Yeah.
I think obviously the doggist is successful for a few reasons, but I think the name is one of those things that sort of from the very beginning can change the way the people perceive it. And it just makes sense. Right. The doggist.
And why do you think, you said a moment ago that you think the name is successful for a few reasons? What are those reasons to you?
Well, beyond the name, I think that the simplicity of my photos is sort of, you know, it's sort of formal.
Okay.
And, you know, it's dogs, so obviously it's like one of the most likable things.
Sure.
And that the other, also that, like I was saying, I create, everyone's my brand ambassador once their dog is up. So, you know, if I photograph Pookie and Pookie's dad is works at New York Times, then I have everyone in the office looking at Pookie and my website.
Okay.
Or if I photograph Piney, who is Ira Glass's dog, then Ira Glass will use my image as the lead image for his story on This American Life. So that happens, right?
Yeah.
So that's sort of the nature of, like, sort of one of the benefits of doing it.
For sure. And is that how then, Elias, that, because you sort of detailed, like, hey, I got 10,000 followers here, and then HuffPost picked it up, 10,000 more, and BuzzFeed picked it up. But I mean, at some point, something kind of much more exponential must have happened, because as I mentioned, I think before you joined us on the air, I mean, at this point, last I knew, at least, you had 1.7 million Instagram followers. So 10,000 here, 10,000 there. I mean, a lot of us would be thrilled with those kind of numbers. But how did it elevate to those kind of numbers?
Well, you know, that's something people ask me, and the only answer is that content is king.
Yeah.
Regardless of your strategy to market the content, what is the content? So
yeah,
I'm taking beautiful portraits of people, dogs, and making them seem like they're human. And that's sort of the signature of my aesthetic, is that it seems like they know. It seems like they know that they're having their portrait taken, like they're, it personifies them even more than we already like to anyway.
Yeah.
And so what I'm good at is getting dogs to look into the lens, and that makes it, you know, it creates drama where there's a dog walking down the street to take a pee, and I'm making it seem like they're having this sort of moment where they're sharing their story and they want the world to see them.
Describe a little bit more about your technique then. I mean, how exactly do you work? Because it does seem like, I mean, I've seen stories or little video pieces, whatever, where you've got tennis balls and other things. So mm-hmm. And then you get way down on the ground with the sort of all essential knee pads on helping you and stuff.
Yeah.
But take us through, like, after we finish this interview, you walk out and you're ready to shoot and you see a dog. So what happens? Just walk us through, like, just a kind of a typical encounter.
So I'll walk up to the owner on their side and say, excuse me, may I take a photo of your dog? Or if it's a rare breed, I'll say, may I take a photo of your Bouvier or your Toller, or so that they know that I'm at least know something.
Yeah. They appreciated something special. Yeah.
That's right. And it catches them off guard and they say, oh, sure. But usually they'll say, yeah, okay, sure, go ahead. Because I think it's something a lot of people ask of dog owners anyway.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I very quickly and adeptly go to the, you know, go to my knees, because I have knee pads on, and the squeaky ball comes out, and I have their dog sort of spellbound.
Yeah.
And sitting and staring at me, and, you know, they'll often say, oh, yeah, good luck getting his photo. He's really bad. He's terrible at taking pictures. And that's never true.
Well, never true in your hands, probably. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, so there are various reasons why I am good at doing it. One of them is that the surprise factor is important. So the dog doesn't know who I am. They don't know that I'm bluffing with a tennis ball or the treat. So they'll they'll do a couple good sits to see if, you know, if they can
get,
you know, be good and get the tennis ball.
Yeah, yeah.
As manipulative as it sounds. but yeah, like, you know, they sit, and they do a sit, and that's when I get the first few photos. And I, you know, if they're not paying attention to me directly, then I'll start making some noises like, and like that. And it sort of just snaps their brain out of the commotion of New York. And I have a moment with them.
Yeah.
And that's what you see.
Sure. And so, like, how long would that take from the moment you walk up and say, hey, can I take your dog's picture, to when you feel like you've got what you can or need for that particular dog?
Pretty quick. It's like a minute or so, a minute or
wow.
two.
Wow. Okay.
And then I'll have a small conversation with the owner. I'll say, what's his name? How old is he? And is there something interesting or funny about him, something he does, you know, and just to get them to start to say something about the dog.
Yeah.
And that ends up being a very funny aspect of the post as well, is sort of the thing about them.
A little identifying detail. Yeah.
Yeah. Not, you know, it's like, I don't want to go into a huge, you know, thing cause about the dog, because it's often, it would get redundant, you know.
Oh, sure.
He's a rescue, he's blah, blah, blah. And, but if there's something that sort of, that sums up and expresses their character more than the picture would, it adds to the picture, then I think that it's a good piece of texture to add.
For sure. How many encounters like that would you have in a given day, and or how many times are you posting in a given day?
Yeah. So I photograph maybe 3 or 4 days a week, and I'm going out and I'm getting about 10 to 30 dogs.
Wow.
Depending on how ambitious I'm going to be that day, and that's just, you know, it's like dogs per hour. And right now the DPH is low because it's
the weather,
miserable and wet outside, and no one really wants to be walking a dog anyway.
Right.
And there's salt everywhere, so they have to track that back inside and worry about their paws getting cracked.
Yeah.
But you know, I'll walk around and I'll go to a destination. I'll say I want to go to Central Park. I want to go to Prospect Park, and I'll just sort of suit up and go and see what I get. And
yeah.
Have lunch and then get a few more on the way back. And I'm sort of, it's fun and relaxing, and there's no real rush about it. Generally there's no shortage of dogs in New York.
Sure. And it's interesting what you said about the DPH, especially in the kind of cooler, wetter weather, because I was thinking in a way that with the recent storm might even be like a boon to your work, just because it shifts the landscape and what dogs and their humans are doing on a given day. And I think a few days ago I did see, you know, a number of photos that you did post that were clearly dogs were in the storm, in the snow.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it just seems like in some ways, even if it might reduce the DPH, just like what you're seeing is different than 4 days earlier or 4 days.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the snow, the big snow of the year, there's usually one every year or two, is a huge day for me. And I'll go out extra early and I'll be out for much longer because the images come out so clean and everything's white and there's snow on the dog's faces. And you're right. The aesthetic of it is sort of unique. But so there is that day of the year, and that's been a great part of my series every year.
Sure.
But I think after that, then it's just dogs trying to avoid the salt, and there's brown snow everywhere. And, I mean, that's funny, too. And what's funny also is the boots. Dogs wear boots, little rubber booties on their feet. So that is a feature of the images this time of year, too.
Well, no, there's definitely a series that captures that, I think, in the book. But here's the thing, Elias. By the way, this is I'm speaking with the photographer Elias Weiss-Friedman, also known as the Doggist, which you probably already know him if you're one of his 1.7 million followers on Instagram. We're in our final moments of our conversation, but if you'd like to ask Elias a question about dogs, photographing dogs, related stuff to the Doggist, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So now that you are an established photographer, obviously huge following on social media, I'm just curious how that works in a sort of a different sense. I mean, one of my best photographer friends for years is a hotshot photographer, and I've really come to understand how often underappreciated photographers can be in all kinds of ways. Like somebody invites you over to a party or a celebration, they, hey, can you bring your camera? Suddenly, without that person thinking about it, you're sort of expected to be working in a way. Do you have those sorts of experiences or others where people don't take seriously what you do and just say, hey, I take pictures, Elias takes pictures, what's the big deal?
That's right. It is a common thing. And I get a lot of emails from fans saying, like, hey, we were just wondering if you could meet Coco in the park on Saturday. We'll be there. Or, like, you know, come to North Carolina. And, yeah, it's sort of, they expect that it's sort of this free service because they see other people, you know, other people's dogs. But sometimes I'll oblige them. But, you know, the whole experience for me is this sort of natural roaming. And
right.
It's a very sort of...
spontaneous.
Holy... It's spontaneous. It's this sort of very holy time, I guess you could say. Like this, it's something I don't want to sort of. I don't like making appointments with people.
Right.
So then I have to sit there for 10 minutes while they're late, and the dog isn't very well behaved, and then there's the whole follow up. So yeah, as a photographer, there's sort of multiple levels of doing what you do.
Yeah.
You know, you start as a beginner, become an amateur. And if you're a professional, most of the time you have clients, right?
Sure.
And the clients pay you, and you're sort of at the, you know, if they don't like it, then you have to redo it. And you work on a tight schedule, and you make appointments. However, as an artist, the next sort of level, which is harder to reach, is I make my own times. I pick my own subject, and I decide what I want to share. And I get paid because... I have, you know, a publishing career right now, and I do some sponsored stuff with bigger brands, and that's how I make it work. But
yeah,
sort of the artist attitude is I will do, you know, when I'm inspired, then I will bring out my camera and I'll take photos.
Well, that,
yeah, it's hard to.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because it didn't really occur to me that somebody would actually get in touch with you and say, hey, we're going to be at the park at 4 p.m. Can you come shoot? That does make sense now that you say that happened. I guess I was thinking also, too, that, of course, we're living in an era where nearly everyone has a camera in their pocket. So, worse, many of us have a phone full of photos of our dogs or cats or whatever in that phone. So, to me, it would seem, again, that people wouldn't necessarily fully understand or respect that's a far cry taking pictures with your smartphone from what you do. And if you just look at the photos that are on most people's phone, including my own, in contrast to what you have on the doggist or in the book, that contrast is pretty sharp. But it just, again, I just think people don't necessarily understand the realm and world of a professional photographer and how that really needs to be respected.
That's right. But at the same time, you know, I really enjoy what I do. It's not like I consider it to be work most of the time. If they have a dog and I have my camera, I'm happy to take a photo of them. That's what I do. So, you know, it's not like I'm a studio photographer and I need lights or anything. And
it's not like people are coming up and saying, hey, can you shoot a wedding? We're having a wedding coming up
exactly.
In a couple of Sundays or whatever. Yeah. So
that's right.
So, Elias, we're just sort of in the final moments for you, but I want to be sure to touch at least briefly on the Give a Dog a Bone program. Maybe tell me a little bit about that program and how that works.
Sure. Well, the shelter series, the dogs in the shelter, are an important part of the story of dogs. And as my mission as a dog is to sort of tell the overall story of dogs. And I think that giving these dogs exposure and their organization's exposure is an important thing for me to do as someone with influence. And so that's sort of essentially why it's important for me to be doing that, is these dogs need help and I can help them.
And how exactly does that work, just for people who may not be familiar with the Give a Dog a Bone program?
So, yeah, the Give a Dog a Bone program is essentially I go to shelters and photograph the dogs receiving a bone, a rawhide bone. And then people can sponsor that post. And within the caption, it will say, you know, bone given by this person. And the bones are like $50 to $100. And this year I was able to give 100% of that back to shelters, all the shelters that I visited. So it's sort of this win-win. I get to tell the story of dogs. I get to increase their chances of being adopted exponentially, and people get to participate in my project and also end up supporting the shelters monetarily.
Right. And also as part of that, an offshoot of that, and certainly throughout your book and, of course, on the Instagram, you like gorgeous photos of pit bulls. It seems like you have a real soft spot for pit bulls.
Yes. And highlighting the plight of pit bulls has sort of been the story, you know, the main story of shelters is like, why are all these dogs sort of in shelters? And they're mostly pit bulls, especially around New York City. And it's a sad aspect of what I do. And it's never a walk in the park like I'm usually doing. I'm going to these sort of loud, close quarter environments that smell like dog crap and photographing these dogs that have been going slightly insane because they're in a cage, and having these moments with them there, that can be a little bit, you know, I have to be a little bit desensitized myself, or else I'll kind of, I'd take home all the dogs.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that's important for me to be showing my audience. And most of what I do is very happy. I like the dog has to be a happy place, but you have to mix it up and be real.
Yeah. Well, it's really cool. And it just kind of gives obviously much more depth and breadth to the mission of the doggist. So we've been speaking with Elias Weiss Friedman. He's the doggist, and the website is thedoggist.com, and Instagram and Twitter, et cetera. The handle is @thedoggist. So Elias, and again, the book is available wherever you get your books, and it's just chock full of amazing photographs and all kinds of breeds and themes and cool stuff and give the dog a bone elements and whatever. So thank you so much, Elias, for joining us today on Talking Animals, and keep up the good work.
Awesome. Great speaking to you, Duncan.
All right. Thanks again. In a few minutes, I'll chat briefly with Loretta Williams of the St. Francis Society Animal Rescue about its Hem Bingo on Domingo event this Sunday. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner on this canine-centric edition of Talking Animals. Here's Pete Holmes with a portion of a piece called Dropped a Dog in today's comedy corner. I'm talking him.
Oh, that's okay. Hear the empathy noise. I didn't wound a dog. I'd be crazy if I was like, okay, show's going pretty good. What next? I killed a dog. You know those things everyone loves? I ended one. I wouldn't tell you guys if I did that. I would save that for my serial killer journal. Just like, could man be so sweet? Is that just me? That's the craziest thing about serial killers, is the journaling. I understand killing some people, but who wants to go home like, big day? Take it easy, Doogie Howser. You killed a lot of people today. Take it easy. So I dropped a dog. I didn't know you can't. Did you know? Maybe there's one person I'm helping. You can't drop dogs. If you want to put a dog down, they're like little old people. They need help. They have arthritis and joints. They're like, be gentle. You gotta be gentle. If you want to put a dog down, you have to kneel as if before a king and lay it down. If there's mud, put your jacket down. They need our help. I was raised with cats. You can bowl a cat. Do you understand? You can't hurt a cat. They're infallible. They're like the Pope or a Pharaoh. You can't hurt a cat. You can pick up a cat any way you want. You can grab a cat by the fat behind its neck. It'll yield to that move from its youth, straight up with that look on its face like, this is degrading us both. I'm 6'6". That's like a kitty cat skyscraper. I'll go as high as I want, give it a little bend to the knee, a hoist into the air. Cat's cool, baby. He's unfazed. He doesn't even blink. Do cats blink? He doesn't even blink. They'll just do 13 kitty cat somersaults, smoke a tiny cat cigarette, land on all fours, be like, self, I'm a cat. He'll disappear into a nearby shrub. You won't see him for 2 months. He'll be fine. He'll forge for himself. He'll come back on a rainy Thursday covered in lo mein, just like, I've returned. Not because I like you, but because I choose to come back.
That's Pete Holmes with a portion of a piece called Dropped a Dog, taken from his CD, Nice Try, The Devil. Let's move now into the conversation with Loretta Williams, event coordinator at the St. Francis Society Animal Rescue, about this Sunday's Hem Bingo on Domingo. Let's welcome Loretta Williams, in fact, right now to Talk Animals. Good morning, Loretta.
Good morning. Thank you for having St. Francis on your show today.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. First, why don't you just tell us briefly what St. Francis Society Animal Rescue is, what it does, what its basic mission is.
Well, St. Francis is one of the oldest and largest animal rescues in the Tampa Bay area. We're all volunteer, a 501c3 nonprofit, and our mission is to save the lives of homeless cats and dogs by providing them veterinary care, spay neutering, and placing them in safe, loving, forever homes.
Well, that sounds pretty darn good.
Yes. And we also help, like, strapped pet owners keep their pets and help them out with medical and food assistance as our resources allow. And we rely solely on donations. We receive no government assistance. And all the donations go directly to help needy animals.
Wow. Okay. So that sounds, you know, very ambitious, and that resources, as you say, are critical. So I assume that various events and things help kind of underwrite those efforts. So, which probably brings us in a way to Ham Bingo on Domingo. What does that mean? What the heck are we talking about here, Loretta?
Well, Ham Bingo is Hamburger Mary's in Ybor City has these charity events, and it's not exactly your typical church basement bingo. It's hosted by one of Tampa Bay's premier drag queens, and it's a lot of fun, and you're guaranteed to laugh. And so come on out this Sunday, January 31st, and the event begins at 4:30, maybe with drinks and an early dinner, and then bingo starts promptly at 5:30. We'll have great prizes, and you can make your reservations by calling 813-241-MARY.
And we should say, even though we can't really talk about the cost of like bingo cards and other things on the air here, basically the idea is that you come, you pay for your bingo card, the money that is yielded from that goes directly to St. Francis Society Animal Rescue. So it's really a fundraiser and a pretty direct fundraiser. I think all that money goes to you, does it not?
Exactly.
Yeah.
These events by Hamburger Mary's help so many rescues and nonprofits in the Tampa area. It's really a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and like you say, it is definitely not your mother's or grandmother's bingo at the church thing. In fact, I told this, I think, one other time on the air, but 2 or 3 years ago, I had my son over here after the show, and we were going to spend the night and go off on a spring break trip or something. So we were in Ybor, so we just kind of walked over to Hamburger Mary, and Drag Queen Bingo was underway. And so it was like, you know, 9 or 10 at the time. So it made for some stirring dinner conversation. But it's a total blast, and it's a great thing. And again, I love that they do this in an ongoing way to help all these rescues, as you say. Where could people find out more if they wanted to check out a few more details? Either is there a Facebook page or on the website that they could check details if they didn't catch them all?
Yes, they can go to our website at stfrancisrescue.org. And we're also on Facebook, so
great.
They can visit our Facebook page.
Great. Okay, and again, that's this Sunday, the 31st, at Hamburger Mary's in Ybor City. And again, things get underway at 4:30, but bingo starts promptly. And again, you do not want to be scolded by it being anything less than prompt. So, and we hope that people turn out and have a blast and put a couple more bucks in the pockets of the St. Francis Society Animal Rescue. So thanks, Loretta, for taking the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lurie and Radioactivity. Rolling into the noon hour constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Koch. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a copy of the latest Joe Jackson CD, Fast Forward, an underrated, terrific album, by the way. So let's get in to Name That Animal Tune right now. This is a giveaway, by the way, and please only participate if you haven't won something from WMF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a copy of the great new Joe Jackson CD, Fast Forward, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. Again, keeping with our sort of canine orientation day, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. We'll probably take our guesses off the air because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lurie is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of Radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, February 3rd, when I'll be convening a panel discussion about service animals, legitimate and maybe not so legitimate service animals, how it works for animals to wear those vests, what happens when people game the system. The final trigger for this panel was the recent news coverage of a turkey ostensibly functioning as a service animal on a International Play. Hope you'll join me for that. Also, hope you visit our website, talkinganimals.net. Again, please check out our thank you gifts for Fund Drive. Pledges of various levels and fast, easy ways to make those pledges in support of Talking Animals and, of course, on the broader scale in support of WMNF. The website also features all sorts of information, archives, podcasts, past Talking Animals programs, links to Facebook, Twitter, and more. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And we'll catch you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. This is WMNF Tampa. Community Conscious Radio, Blarendon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. We'll catch you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for NPR News and Rob Lurie up next.